Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to PhillyFanatics.com, Philly Sports Talk. I am Eric Fisher. With me on the line, Gordon Glantz. Big Vikings-Eagles game to discuss today. And Gordon, the Vikings are no longer undefeated. How did the Eagles do this?
Well, it's a normal ebb and flow of a season. I think I said that last week, that the Vikings might be a good team, but they're not a 5-0 or what would have been a 6-0 type of good team. And, you know, the Eagles might be a mediocre team, but they're not the kind of team that would go lose three games in a row. I mean, they're not, you know, so it's kind of an ebb and flow of a season. And you know, the Eagles are a team coming off two road losses coming home. And I know I'm not up on Las Vegas trends, but I know that, that would kind of favor the Eagles just the way the season would go. So just because of that, I felt the Eagles had a good chance. When you get into the matchups, there were some problematic areas that were a concern for the Eagles, but there were some matchups that the Eagles took advantage of. And I think when you ask how they did it, you have to look at the Vikings offensive line that's depleted by injuries. And the Eagles really took advantage of it with pressure on Sam Bradford, who is not very mobile, and they know that. And I think they also kind of knew something about him. They were looking to strip the ball from Bradford whenever they could. Instead of tackling, they were reaching out for the ball. I think they kind of knew where he kept the ball. Maybe he keeps it a little low. I don't know. You'd have to ask them, I guess. But so really defensively, after the way they played defensively the last 2 weeks, I think they did it with defense. Obviously, the touchdown from Josh Huff. So that wasn't an offensive touchdown, and Winston didn't really have a big game. Nobody really had a big game offensively, statistically. So they really did it with defense and, you know, some solid special teams, and they got some turnovers. But that's how they did it, and they kind of caught a team that was due to lose, and Eagles were due to get back on a winning track, and I just think that was, you know, just a big part of it. When you get away from the X's and O's, I think that was it.
Yeah, I think, the more I looked at this game as I was writing the preview for PhillyFanatics.com, the more winnable I thought it was for the Eagles. I still ended up picking the Vikings in a low-scoring game. And if you take out Josh Huff's kickoff return for touchdown, but maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe they would have won anyway. But what I saw was, like you said, there were matchups. And we were concerned with the Vikings' defense against the Eagles' offensive line matchup. And I think with good reason. But what really stood out for me was, the Vikings missing both starting offensive tackles. They can't run the ball. And as Fletcher Cox said after the game, I don't know if he meant to be ironic or not, but he said, if you can't run the ball enough, we can be a lights-out defense. And I know what he's saying is that, if you don't run the ball on them, they can just rush the passer. And I think that's what they did today, if they're not fearful to run. And Gordon, really, that's – and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself because I don't want to ruin next week's show before the Cowboys game. But, the last 2 weeks what the Lions and Redskins did against the Eagles was run the ball on them. And the Vikings just couldn't do that at all. So maybe it was a good matchup for the Eagles, and I think you're right. Their familiarity with Bradford certainly helped them.
I think one more thing, Eric, that the Eagles really did well today that they hadn't done any much of at all, and Ray Ninder touched on this after the game as well, they sent other people. It's nice that you can get pressure with your front four, and that's always the way you want to go. But, they were sending linebackers. I think Hicks had a sack, and Bradham had a sack, and they sent Jalen Watkins when he had to go into the game and play slot corner. He got pressure on a blitz, and they were sending other people. And I was afraid they were going to kind of cut back on that, and then they got into the second half, but they didn't. They kept bringing people and putting pressure on Bradford and forcing him to throw sooner than he wanted to. And I think that was really important, and that was something I don't think Minnesota was prepared for.
Yeah, in my article, my game story, I didn't even list everybody, but I listed like six or seven guys who hit Bradford. I mean, like the whole defense hit him just about. Maybe Jalen Mills didn't, and Nolan Carroll, but just about everybody else on defense, got a handle on him at some point. Rodney McLeod had a great game with a tackle. He forced a fumble, forced that first fumble, I believe it was. Or maybe Barwin was the first, and he was the second one. It's a good game when you can't keep track of who forced the fumbles, though. And it had the interception in the end zone, of course, which was a huge play. Gordon, it looked like you take the X's and O's out of it, like you said. Did it look to you like the defense had something to prove today, though, after these last 2 weeks?
Well, I think they felt like it. I mean, it's the Detroit game, you could almost you could break it down and say, look, the Eagles had three really strong defensive games in a row to start the season, and then they had a bye week, so that kind of hurts their momentum, and it also gives Detroit, which was a desperate team at that time, they're playing pretty well now, but they were a desperate team at that time, an extra time to really break the Eagles down on film and look at what they were doing. And as you saw, they scored on the first three possessions in that game and really put the Eagles in a hole. But then the Eagles, you know, came out in the second half of that game and put themselves in a position to win it, really could win it without a Ryan Matthews fumble, because they did play good defense in the second half. I don't know what happened last week, though. I mean, the Redskins just kind of took their manhood from them. I mean, they just beat them up front. They had three running backs that most people hadn't really heard of. I'm sure they're not on anybody's fantasy football rosters, but they're still NFL backs, and when you have holes that are that big to run through, any NFL back's going to get yardage. So last week was just, they were lucky that they were able to, not get beat by worse than they did last week, and the defense really got manhandled. So I think they really had something to prove. They may have said the last 2 weeks, but certainly coming off of last week, there was no excuse to get blown up like they did at the line of scrimmage. And the linebackers were really nowhere to be found. But like Jim Schwartz said, he said it was the front four, it was the linebackers, and it was the secondary, and it was him as well. I mean, it was on, the coaching, and it was also on each level of the defense. And, yeah, I think there was a certain thing, where they felt like they had something to prove. And I think they came out and proved it this week, and it was important to kind of, just have that confidence back to kind of get their swagger back as a unit, because, they're going to need it. They have some tough games coming up, as we touched on last week.
Yeah, and that's why I don't want to get my one concern is for people who are going to. I mean, it's a big victory. It was an important victory. But they're going to face a different team next week. They're going to face a team that loves to run the ball, and we'll see. If the wide nine, the way the Eagles run it, if it will work, or if they'll be exposed by a team running the ball the same way they were by the Redskins. And the Cowboys have a much better offensive line and running attack than the Redskins do. Talk about Sam Bradford briefly. I put it in quotes when I said it's his homecoming. I mean, he's only here for a year, but boy, certainly this did not go the way he wanted to. But not only the hits, but that first interception, Gordon. I'm sure you didn't, but I'll ask it anyway because I almost did. Did you almost feel bad for Sam Bradford?
Yeah, I never had a problem with Sam Bradford. I mean, he didn't ask to be traded here, and I don't know if it was an overly popular trade, but it was more of a mystifying trade than, made people kind of scratch their heads. The Foles for Bradford didn't really seem like it made a whole lot of sense. It was sort of a wash, and the Eagles gave up more in draft picks, but he didn't ask to be traded here, and he kind of struggled early. He had games like what he had today where he threw interceptions in the end zone and things like that, but at the end of last year, he was 7-7 and when he started last year for the Eagles, and the Eagles had a lot of other issues going on. Defensive side of the ball, they struggled. I really had nothing against them. I felt like really they had their best chance of at least being a competitive team this year with him quarterbacking. So, the opportunity for the trade came up. Bridgewater got injured, and the opportunity for the trade came up. And, it turned out being, I think, will be a good trade for both teams. But he's not somebody who was here long enough who really – cost us big games and playoffs and things like that to really develop a whole lot of animosity for him. And I was a little surprised he got booed when he came on the field. I don't think there's enough history there one way or the other to feel to get a big cheer or to get a big boo, but I guess that's Philadelphia for you. So, I felt a little bad for him. He didn't get much help, but I don't have much mercy in my heart for anybody when they're playing against the Eagles. So,
That's what I was referring to. Yeah, I wasn't necessarily referring to any particular dislike for Bradford, but usually when they leave, you're done with them. But I was surprised by the booing too, is how loud it was, because even Bradford said after the game, and as always, I'll say he is a stand-up guy. He always speaks to media after the games and answers questions, and he actually answers questions too. He doesn't blow them off. He said he didn't have any ill will toward the Eagles, and he said, I didn't come in here trying to prove to them they made a mistake by trading me, and he said, I don't have any ill will, and then that was it. We do have Josh Landsberg on the line. So Josh, we've talked a lot about this Eagles game, but we didn't get your opinion yet. Well, let's ask, let's go another way. Because we've been talking about the defense a lot. Josh, how did you think Carson Wentz played today?
Oh, my gosh. I thought he played horribly, honestly. I thought he left a lot out there. He missed a bunch of throws. Nelson Aguilar actually got behind the defense a couple times and was pretty much wide open. He missed those throws. I mean, you have to credit Minnesota's defense. Obviously, they're, I believe, the number one ranked defense in the NFL this year. So you have to credit the defense. They were great, but it was just a sloppy game all around. 8 turnovers. I can't remember the last time I watched a game with that many turnovers in the game. It was a sloppy game by both teams, but yeah, the defense has been great. I'll talk, you know, more about the offense since you got touched on the defense already. But I thought the Eagles were actually going to win this game. We talked about it last week. I thought they had a shot. My prediction was 16-13 Eagles. I thought it was going to be a low-scoring game, so, you know, not too far off of that prediction. It was, you know, the Eagles pretty much had it wrapped up at 21-3, and then the Vikings got that late touchdown to make it 21-10 final. But I thought, you know, I thought he had his moments where he did make some throws and he made some plays, but this is the second week in a row now, which you've got to expect with a rookie quarterback is going to happen. But this is the second week in a row now where he hasn't played well. He had 4 really good weeks. His first 4 weeks, even though they lost the Detroit game, I thought he played really well in that game, but he played bad against Washington, who doesn't have, you know, such an amazing defense, and he played bad against this Vikings team. So I'm a little bit concerned about Carson Wentz in terms of the team overall. I said this, you know, some people before the game, as I was before the game is about to start, I said this is a defining game, even though it's early in the season, not super early, but still pretty early. I thought that if the Eagles would win this game, they would make the playoffs. If they lost this game, they would miss the playoffs, because that's how hard I think the rest of their schedule is the rest of the way. So they did win, but it didn't really give me a lot of confidence in this team. The defense did play much better, and you got to give Jim Schwartz credit, but I thought Carson Wentz did not have a good game at all. And you know, the Eagles wide receivers, Nelson Aguilar, as I said, was open a few times, and Jordan Matthews is being covered by one of the best cornerbacks in the league. So so he didn't get open too many times. But overall, I thought that Carson Wentz had some time, and he had some throws that he could have made that he didn't make.
Building off what Josh said, the offense didn't look all that good. And certainly that's partly due to the Vikings being a terrific defense. But you know, Carson Wentz was not sacked today, which was kind of a surprise. But that also plays into, you know, when you're ahead and you can run, you know, you run the ball more often, your quarterback doesn't get hit as much, and the defense can't, you know, pin their ears back and rush the passer. But, Gordon, I was bothered by the fact that Josh is right. Wentz was off target, but he had, like, at least 4 balls dropped again today, I think. I remember Darryl Green Beckham, who scored a touchdown later, had a ball that hit him, like, in his shoulder pad. Sproles dropped the pass, who you know, normally doesn't drop anything. Someone else dropped one, but and I'm, you know, I still see the same problems, I guess, on offense. Am I, you know, except for the Steelers game, I see the same problems on offense that I've seen all year, and some of them have actually gotten worse. You know, do you see the same thing I'm seeing, or am I looking at it maybe just too negatively? Oh, Gordon, you there? Josh, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know if there were some drops today, but I don't know. You know, you can almost blame Wentz as much for those as the guy who dropped the pass. There was one to Trey Burton out in the flat that was for a sure first down. Ended up going for a fourth down anyway and getting the fourth down. But, you know, Burton got his fingertip on the ball, but you can't really say he should have caught that. And you know, the one that Beckham, I guess, was the closest to kind of hit him in the head or the shoulder or whatever hit him. You know, so, you know, it's not like we can say, you know, there were some real costly drops, but that's a work in progress. I think Wentz needs to, you know, settle down. I don't know if he was really settled down today, but he yeah, I mean, he found a way to win the game. That's what you want from your quarterbacks. There's quarterbacks all over the league who are putting up big numbers this today and every week, and they're all losing, and they don't win games. So, you know, I'll take a guy who finds a way to win games. You know, like they compare him a lot to Alex Smith, and I hope he's more than Alex Smith. But you know, Alex Smith's a guy who wins games. He's not always a guy who, you know, puts up huge numbers, but you know he finds a way to make the play when he needs to. So.
Yeah. Gordon, I don't know if you're doing this on purpose, but you are channeling Carson Wentz, who after the game said, and I quote, "That's what good teams do. They find a way to win." So there you go. Almost word for word, Carson Wentz.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you break down today's game, I mean, he made some. He didn't play great, like Josh said, but he made some nice plays at key times. You know, when they really needed a play to be made, he made a play that at least kept drives going. For a rookie and the situation he's in, every week's not going to be perfect. Every play is not going to be perfect. But 4-2 after six games, I think, is not much to complain about.
Okay, there we go. Go ahead, Josh.
Yes, I just wanted to piggyback real quick on something Gordon said. If he is like Alex Smith, and I was going to say this anyway, even before he brought up Alex Smith, I think you don't want to put your quarterback in harm's way too much, but I think he should be scrambling a little bit more. You saw the 2-point conversion. He had the quarterback sneak where they got the 2-point conversion. You saw him, I was kind of down on him, pretty negative, but just to throw a couple positives, he did run for that big first down. So I think they should get him out. McNabb was here for many years, obviously. Carson Wentz isn't quite as athletic as him, but McNabb made some of his biggest plays when he scrambled and made plays outside the pocket. And I think Wentz maybe stays in the pocket a little bit too long sometimes and should make some big plays down the field outside the pocket. And then he has the opportunity, like he made that play a couple weeks ago to Darren Sproles, where he looked like he was going to run and the defender didn't know if he was going to run or pass it. And then he started to run and threw it to Sproles for a touchdown. So I think he needs to make more plays like that.
Yeah, he almost forget that he's only in his sixth game. And I agree with Gordon and you. I think he'll be more than Alex Smith. I certainly hope so. I think he can do things that Alex Smith can't do. And Alex Smith is a game manager in a good way. He's really good at it. Was it last year or the year before, Gordon, where they went like, I don't think their wide receivers caught a touchdown all year. I think it was 2 years ago.
It was 2 years ago before they got Macklin, yeah.
Yeah,
so it was 2 years ago.
You know,
yeah.
I don't ever expect to see Carson Wentz not have, receivers don't have a touchdown for half a season, let alone the whole season. So, all right, so we're going to go Eagles-Dallas next Sunday, but we will talk about that next Sunday, or before the game, the preview show. So we'll talk more about that next Sunday and where they're going and how they're going to do in that game. Let's shift. The 76ers open their season this coming Wednesday. And I guess what I really want to ask before we get into details on the team and the individuals, and this will take us in there, but – Josh, we'll start with you. How do we evaluate the Sixers this year? What's the criteria for judging them on whether they're having a good season or a bad season?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's going to be really hard to evaluate them because they're not at full strength. I mean, they don't have like half their team or, a lot of players. Nerlens Noel just had a knee surgery and you don't know how long he's going to be out for. Jared Bayless has been hurt. Ben Simmons is hurt. So it's really going to be hard to evaluate this team because, it might be even until Ben Simmons comes back from the injury, if he comes back at all this year, maybe he comes back in January or February, maybe after the All-Star break, something like that. And then maybe you get more of a feel of what this team can be this year and going forward. But I think up until that point, evaluating them, let's say Simmons does come back around February or January, evaluating them from, end of October until beginning of February, something like that, along those lines, the first 3 or 4 months of the season, I think you have to look at how Embiid is playing. I think he's really a corner piece of the team for sure for the future. And you have to look at and see how he plays in the system with Okafor. Can him and Okafor play together? If Nerlens Noel gets healthy, will they make a trade and try to get a point guard or a shooting guard or a small forward in here, which I think they desperately need? I think Noel's injury is a big deal, but I think that Okafor and Embiid are guys that could actually play well together. And, we saw it with two big guys a long time ago. Now the NBA has certainly changed a lot, but you had Tim Duncan and David Robinson, two of the greatest players of all time. I'm not saying they're going to be that, but they were able to play together, two big guys, seven-footers, that were able to play together and win championships together. So I think Embiid could be a guy who could be, play on the perimeter, and Okafor could be down on the box down below, and he could, maybe switch him around if Okafor can develop like a 12-foot jump shot. So I think that how you evaluate them is how those two big guys play together. I think that's the best way to evaluate them, how a couple of the other guys play, and then once they get the guys back from injury, how they kind of work together as a team. But I don't think you can evaluate them at all by wins and losses.
It's funny you mentioned when Ben Simmons is going to come back, and Brett Brown told Keith Pompey of the Inquirer that Ben Simmons will be back in January, and then I'm guessing someone in the organization above him said something to him because he, he walked that back really quickly and said, oh, no, I was just overexcited and, you know, we don't have a timetable. But I think he's hoping for, and that's all I'm hoping for is January, but, you know, we don't really expect him back in January. I think clearly somebody said they're going to be very cautious with Ben Simmons. And I think
his agent came out and said he wants to shut him down for the year. So there's a lot of information coming out there.
Right. So, Gordon, same question for you. Did the Sixers just get a pass for the first half of the year, or until whenever Simmons gets back, or you know, what are we judging them on or evaluating them on?
I mean, unfortunately, because he's not there, and some other guys are hurt as well, it's going to be difficult to really judge them on wins and losses. We're going to have to look at individual players, you know, like Josh said, and see how they develop, and then project down the road, maybe second half of the season, on how they fit together and who fits together, who needs to be moved, and then we'll end up in victories down the road. But it's kind of a shame because I think we were all expecting a little bit more this year out of the Sixers, that they could maybe take a step forward with some of the, you know, getting Simmons in the draft and, you know, Embiid coming back healthy and getting Saric from overseas. That it really seemed like, you know, that's three lottery picks that you're adding to the mix. And it really was an exciting prospect. And, you know, losing Simmons, it kind of changes the whole thing. So, but the way Embiid has been playing, I think it's caused enough for excitement. You know, I think that's going to get people, you know, kind of fired up. I'll be at the opening game Wednesday night. And, you know, Embiid and Saric are going to be the players that I'm going to be looking at. And you know, win or lose, I mean, that's, you know, we just have to kind of – I know it's getting a little old now, you know, to kind of watch these young guys and you know, think, well, we will be good in a couple of years. And, you know, it's a couple of years have gone by and we're still kind of waiting. But, you know, I think like Josh said, how are Okafor and Embiid going to play together? Can they play together? You know, NBA history has shown that two big guys can fit in together if they are good enough. Good basketball players can find a way to play together if they want to, and whether they're both big men or not. I mean, you talk about Mikal and Parrish. Mikal could have been a center, but on the Celtics he was more of a power forward. And obviously the classic case is Duncan, you know, and you know, the San Antonio situation, and you had Sampson and Olajuwon in Houston. I mean, it has happened, so it's not, like, unheard of. Today's game, you know, with three-pointers and the game's played a little different, it's not as common, but Embiid is so athletic, he can do so many different things, that I think it is possible. And I guess that's one of the things we really have to watch unfold, whether you win or whether you lose. I think you have to kind of watch and see that unfold and see if they can play together. It would be great if they could, because it would give them a nice building block.
You know, Okafor and Noel could not play together, though. We did see that last year. But you're right, Embiid brings a different dimension. Part of Noel's problem is he can't shoot beyond, like, about 8 feet, if that far. And you know, to put one of them outside, if you put Okafor outside, you take him out of his best spot, which is down on the low block. But, yeah, so Embiid brings some different things. Gordon, you mentioned the guy who I'm really going to look for. Because for me, Embiid, I think, is the player. And my only question with him is health, and I can't judge that. You know, it's going to be whether he stays healthy or not. The guy I'm really intrigued to watch is Saric, because I want to see how he plays at the NBA level. In the preseason, you know, he had some hot games where he played really well and shot the ball really well, and he had a couple 1-for-7s, you know, and the rest of his game. You know, he'll put up some numbers, assists and stuff like that, some rebounds. I want to watch him on defense. I want to see if he's quick enough to cover the guys, or strong enough to cover the guys he has to cover. You know, I want to see how he plays on offense with the ball, with a first-class pressure defense. In the preseason, you know, you play against a mix of players. But like I said, I'm excited to watch Embiid. And like you guys said, I want to see how he plays with Okafor. And, you know, but I have no questions after watching him in preseason that he can play. And if he's healthy, he's really good. But Saric is the guy, you know, I'm not sure about. And to me, and Josh, tell me if I'm wrong, I mean, the other guys are all interchangeable parts. You know, even Bayless, you know, and is hurt. And I don't expect to see him for a little while, if we see him at all, depending on how bad that wrist is. But, you know, I'm looking for the future. And you know, I guess, you know, Covington could stick around for a little bit. But none of these other guys are part of the future. So are we missing somebody? Is there someone else we should be watching besides Okafor and Embiid? I mean, obviously the guys at Simmons when he gets back, but Okafor, Saric, and Embiid—that's it to me. Am I missing somebody?
No, I would say Rashawn Holmes is not bad. You know, and Jeremy Grant. These guys can be role players down the road. I don't know if Josh has anybody else, but
Yeah, Jeremy Grant I like also. You know, I think Robert Covington could be, you know, could be a part of the team, you know, bench player, maybe something like that. But I'm glad you brought up Sarich, because I think, Eric, it was either you or Gordon on the show last week or the week before who said that he seems like he could be a guy, could be like a 15-point-per-game, maybe 7 rebounds, 6 assists type guy. And you know who that kind of reminds me of, who wasn't really beloved here in Philadelphia, and I think that's because he got a, you know, max contract $80 million deal, and that would be Andre Iguodala, not quite the numbers of Andre Iguodala, maybe not quite as good as Andre Iguodala, but along those types of lines, I don't know if he'll be the defender, obviously, that Andre Iguodala is, but if he can put up, you know, numbers kind of similar to that, that would be really a really nice presence on this team.
Yeah, if he can put up, you know, cover all the stat bases, not be, you know, not have 20 points, but you're right, in there, yeah, he's not going to be the defender that Iguodala was, but if he can be a decent defender and still put up those numbers, I think we're happy. Josh, the spot that always comes to me with the Sixers, and it's going to be the problem this year, and I think it's going to be why they're not going to win that many games, and we'll get to how many games they'll win in just a minute, is point guard. And they're going in again with Sergio Rodriguez and T.J. McConnell. Like you said, Bayless is hurt, but he's not a true point guard, really. Is it tough to watch them go into the season with those guys as the point guards?
Oh, it's definitely tough to watch, and I think if Simmons was healthy, he'd be your starting point guard, actually, even though he's 6'10". I think he's got that type of player. He's got that type of handle that he could be kind of that point forward type of player, that Magic Johnson type of player. Not saying he's going to be as good as Magic Johnson, but that type of, you know, Magic Johnson was 6'9", and he was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, point guards of all time. So, you know, Ben Simmons would have been your starting point guard. He's hurt. So now you have to have kind of these guys who are backup players on other teams now be your starters. And that's why I think they're, you know, in desperate need of making a trade. I know Simmons is going to come back, but it wouldn't hurt to even have, you know, you could play Simmons really anywhere on the floor, to be honest. So he doesn't have to be your point guard, or he can handle the ball sometimes. I think they need to trade for a point guard or a shooting guard, someone in that backcourt that can be a presence to really make them watchable this season, to be honest, because otherwise they're going to lose games by 15, 20 points a lot of times. They're not going to be competitive. So I really think that Noel is the guy to trade. Unfortunately, he got hurt, and I don't know what team is going to want him with the injury. But, you know, if they could make a move, you know, I think that's what they have to do. But they're going to be unwatchable for a lot of games. And actually, you mentioned how many wins, which we're going to get to in a second. I have a question to throw out there to both you guys. I'm kind of curious. My team, obviously the Sixers, and my new hometown team, the Lakers, who were both pitiful last year, the two worst teams in basketball. Do you think between the two of them, will their win total equal the 8th spot in the Eastern Conference? Will they make the playoffs between the two of them?
That's a good question.
That would mean they'd have to win about 20 games.
I'll say yeah.
Probably about 40 wins would get them the 8th spot in the playoffs in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah. I think it'll be close, but I think they get there. I think they get there. Speaking of which, Josh, let's do the wins. How many wins do you expect the Sixers to get this year? They had 10 last year.
Yeah, they had 10 last year. It's really hard. I mean, I think they're going to be better than that. I think they'll win more than 10 games because it's going to be pretty hard to repeat that horrific of a season. And Simmons will hopefully come back. So with Simmons back, you know, for the second half of the season, maybe, or the last third of the season, I think they'll get some more wins that way toward the end of the season. So, I'm going to say if he's back for like the last, you know, maybe 30 games, something like that, along those lines, last 25 games, maybe they win half those. You got 12 to 15 wins maybe with Ben Simmons and, maybe another 5. I'll put it at 20 wins. How about that? They'll double their total.
20 wins.
Year, 20 wins.
Double those. Gordon, how about you?
Unfortunately, I was looking at 20 to 25 for sure, you know, before the injuries. I'm going to have to say about, I'll say 17 wins.
Oh, and I'll go right in the middle there. I was going to go with 19. So we're all in that, and I was also in around the 25 range, so, you know, somewhere 23, 25, so then we're down to 17, 18, 19, 20 in there. All right, we're going to switch to archive in just a minute, talk a little bit Flyers and then do final thoughts. Maybe a little baseball, too. So thank you for listening. Those who are listening live, please check out PhillyConnects.com. Philly story, Eagles story, excuse me, Eagles game story is up there, my column off the Eagles. NBA stuff coming up, Sixers preview coming up, lots of great stuff coming to Flyers Notebook. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week before the Eagles-Cowboys game. All right, Gordon, let's stay with you here on the Flyers. Give me an impression, something from the past week that, you know, that impressed you or didn't impress you from the past week.
Well, one thing I really like with the Flyers, I know they're you know, 500 right now, but I like that they're getting offense from a lot of different guys right now, and I think that's important. You know, we talked before the season about secondary scoring to prop up guys. You can't always count on Giroux, Voracek, and Giroux's actually off to kind of a slow start, but they're getting, you know, Matt Reed scoring and Voracek's getting to pick up a lot of points. And, you know, I talked about the need for Voracek to have a good year again, and he is. And, you know, Simmons has 4 goals. And, you know, I think it's Couturier's off to a decent start. And, you know, and Konechny has a lot of assists already, and we're expecting a lot from him as a rookie. So I think, you know, and Matt Reed, obviously, you know, Matt Reed's, you know, doing he seems like Matt Reed of his first 2 years as opposed to the Matt Reed of the last 2 years. So that's a real positive for me, that a lot of guys are scoring now and getting confidence. It doesn't mean they're going to score at the rate they are right now, but at least they're playing. At least they're not going, you know, 10 games without a goal to start the season. Things like that that would really help, you know, get guys to press and get them to struggle, and then they go through tough seasons. So I think that's a real positive right now, even though, you know, their record isn't great yet. Or maybe never will be great. I think that they're getting, you know, some offense. A lot of guys are contributing right out of the gate.
Hey, if Matt Reed keeps up his current pace, he'll score 82 goals. Hopefully, that'll be amazing. I believe he's tied for the NHL lead in goals, which certainly is a pleasant surprise. Josh,
I want to throw in, I've always been in Matt Reed's corner. A lot of people have been negative on him. I've always said he's a good player. And, you know, if he scores some goals, he gets more power play time. He gets to play up with other skilled players, and you know, it just kind of feeds on itself. So I always kind of felt he had that ability. You know, we saw it in his first 2 seasons. So I don't think he'll score 82 goals, but if he scored 20 to 25 again, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, I'm guilty as charged on that one. So you're right, Gordon. You've always been in his corner. I'm guilty on the other side right now. Josh, how about you? Impression from the first week?
Well, Gordon, you know, kind of hit on a lot of the same things that I was thinking as well. But I'll add one more thing in there. I think Dave Haxtell coaching has been pretty good. You know, he has a lot of young players on his team and a bunch of veterans as well. So mixing the young players and the veterans together and getting them to play well together, I think is, you know, really important. And I think that he's done a good job. And as Gordon said, you know, they're 500, so they're not, you know, lighting the world on fire. They're not off to a tremendous start, but they did have a pretty tough schedule, I think, to start out the season. You know, Eric, you alluded to it before the season started. You were worried about their first few games, how they would do, and they got a couple of surprise victories, a couple of surprise, you know, points here and there in overtime. And so I think the coaching has been good to start the season, and you got to give credit to Ron Hextall as well for putting this team together and getting a bunch of young players and drafting well. So I go with coaching and general manager, and I think that's been impressive so far early on in the season.
Yeah, I'll give you one negative on the coach, and I like him a lot, but I'm troubled that they can't score in the first period. And, like, I think they won one goal in the first period this year, and that's troublesome to me. And they fell behind 2-0 last night, and they came back with, you know, 2-0 early in the second, and then all of a sudden they scored 4 more the rest of the second period and took control of the game against the Hurricanes. But, you know, I'm a little troubled that they had one goal in the first period. They couldn't have started. However, I will, Josh, I agree with you on his overall performance, and I think one thing he did last night is he broke up the Mark Streit, Ivan Provorov duo, which I know it's a veteran and a rookie, but style-wise it doesn't make sense to me. Provorov likes to get up in the play, and you got Streit, who's very good at getting up in the play, but as far as I'm concerned, is subpar in his own end at this point in his career. And, you know, I don't think that's a good guy to have a rookie with. And now he's put him with Brandon Manning, who, speaking of surprises, is just like Matt Reed. Brandon Manning might be their best defenseman so far this year. If not, he's in the mix, which I think is a surprise to a lot of people. He's a guy who's an extra guy, and people thought he might get sent down or whatever. And my goodness, he's making a case to stay when the other defensemen who are injured get back or suspended and injured. So I think that was a good move on his part last night, and it'll be interesting to see how that worked out well last night. We'll see if it keeps working. I want to get a quick thing in on the World Series. We have the Cubs, who haven't been in the World Series since 1945 and haven't won it since 1908. And then we have the Indians, who haven't been in it since 1997 and haven't won since 1948. Josh, your impression of these two long suffering fan bases, who's going to win the World Series?
Who's going to win the World Series? Well, before I give that answer, I'll first off by saying that I think that if you're not a fan of either of these teams, I think it's just going to be a fun series to watch, and you could really root for both of them because both teams, you know, maybe you're rooting more for the Cubs since Cleveland got their championship in basketball, but I think you'd really root for either one of these teams because, as you said, it's been so long for both these long-suffering franchises, these long-suffering fans for these baseball teams, and I think the Cubs are going to do it. It's been 108 years. I think that it's going to be a close series. It might go seven games, but I just think it's the Cubs' year. They really came through. I thought the Dodgers might have won the NLCS, actually. They were up 2-1 and had control of that series, and Kershaw throwed a pitch, but the Cubs came back and won three in a row, and I just think they're on a roll. And, you know, the Indians have had a long period of rest, which I think has hurt them or might hurt them, but being off for that long since they wrapped up their series early. So I think that the Cubs are going to win it. Maybe in seven games, of course, or maybe six or seven games along those lines. Of course, a rule that I think shouldn't be in place, I think we all agree on this one, the All-Star Game, the only sport where the All-Star Game comes into play, and the American League does have home field advantage, so that might come into play, and the Indians might get the edge there. But I really think it should go to the team with the best record, and that was the Cubs. So the Cubs should have home field advantage. But that's a story for another time. But I still think the Cubs are going to win the series, and I think that they have more in their arsenal than the Indians do.
Gordon, how about you?
On the series, well, I think the Cubs have the better team on paper, but, you know, as you know, it doesn't always go that way. So, you know, I feel like they're cursed. You know, like you said, 1908. So I kind of feel like just based on that, you know, I would have to go with Cleveland in a long series, like Josh said. I have to say, though, I can't feel all, you know, warm and fuzzy about the situation. You know, we spent this show talking about the Eagles, haven't won since 1960, and we talked about the Flyers. They've been to the final six times since they won the Cup twice and haven't won. So as much as I'm a nice liberal heart, bleeding heart liberal, you know, in everyday life, I have no kindness in my heart for anybody, you know, until they've suffered like I suffer. So I can't cheer for, you know, Chicago. They have won other championships, so I can't feel, you know, I can't really feel that bad for them because the Cubs haven't. So it should be exciting. It will also be intriguing also, guys, because, you know, the baseball playoffs, I mean, we just celebrated the Phillies winning the World Series in 1980. It was October 21st. This is going to go into November, and, you know, Chicago and Cleveland are not the warmest of cities. So, I mean, it'll be really interesting watching some of these games. You might see snow flurries falling during some of these games. So, you know, you reap what you sow by having the playoffs extended the way it is. So that'll be another interesting thing to watch in these games as well.
You might have to come out with the convict with the snow clearing thing like Bill Belichick had in New England that one year for the field goal.
Yeah.
Maybe clear space for the play. We don't have time, but I could go off on my cute little Cubbies rant, but because someone in L.A. beat me to it, I was kind of annoyed. I mean, I've written it before, but for this year, the idea that the Cubs are these underdogs, yes, they haven't won it forever, but, boy, they are a big market team, and you know, I don't like them being presented as this underdog team. They have a lot of money. They went out, yeah, they've been a big market team for 30-some years, and they went out, and they got Theo Epstein as a general manager, paid him a lot of money. They got Joe Maddon, who, if he's not the best manager in baseball, is one of the best managers in baseball. They brought in all sorts of players, big contracts. I don't want to hear about that. I'm happy for the fan base if they win, but I don't want to hear the Cubs presented as this, you know, sweet little underdog story. It's a big market team. They should have been in the playoffs in the World Series since 1945. It's ridiculous. All right, let's move on to final thoughts. By the way, I you know, Josh, you're right. It's not played on. I think the Cubs are going to win, but you're right. It's not played on paper. If it was played on paper, the Indians wouldn't be in the World Series, quite honestly. They would have been out two rounds ago in last round. All right, final thoughts, Josh.
I'm going to continue with the World Series talk about these two teams just a little bit. I wanted to mention a couple other things about it, and I think that it's remarkable that whichever team ends up going on to win, you're going to have over the course of 12 years, so since 2004 when the Red Sox won and then the White Sox won in 2005, and then whether the Indians win or the Cubs win, it doesn't really matter which team wins. between those three teams that win the World Series over that 12-year span, both gone over 200 years between their last championship combined, those three teams, over 200 years between before their last championship. Just remarkable that we're going to have, no matter which team wins, that type of history in over the, you know, over the last 12 years that we've seen, been watching baseball. And, you know, it's very interesting. The Red Sox won in 04, you know, they hadn't won since 1918, and the White Sox won the next year in 2005, and they hadn't won since, you know, the early 1900s. So, you know, we're going to have that same similar situation again with either the Cubs or the Indians winning. We haven't, you know, the Cubs obviously said since 1908, and the Indians haven't won since the 40s. So, I think it's an interesting story, and it's I think I'm on the other side of it. I think you guys are a little bit more negative about it. I think it's a feel-good story no matter which team wins. I think it's I agree with Gordon a little bit though about the Cubs and Chicago fans, because you did have the Bulls who won 6 championships, and so it's kind of hard to, if you're a 4-for-4 guy like we are in Philly here, it's hard to feel bad for Chicago fans. But I think it's, you know, if you're a huge baseball fan and maybe not a basketball fan, then you got to feel for some of those Cubs fans. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it should be a great series and great pitching matchups and some great hitters, and should be a fun series to watch.
Okay. As a history buff, I should point out the president when the Indians won was last time was Harry Truman, and the Cubs was Teddy Roosevelt when last time they won the World Series. So, Gordon, your final thought.
Yeah, my final thought, you want to talk about a rigged media. I'm not going to go that far and say it's rigged, but I think the media in the city is kind of missing the boat a little bit with the Temple House football team. That was a nationally televised game they had Friday night on ESPN, and really a big win against a very good South Florida team. And played, you know, perhaps their best game since they beat Penn State to open last season. I mean, they played a really good game on both sides of the ball, they put themselves in a position now at 5-3 with the tiebreaker over South Florida to be, with 4 winnable games. I'm not saying they're going to win all 4, but even if they win 3 of the last 4, to win their division, the American Athletic Conference Eastern Division, and then be in the championship game again and be the first Temple team ever to be in a bowl game in back-to-back seasons. And, you know, I wish they get a little bit more attention in the city. I mean, they play on Lincoln Financial Field. And it is, you know, I think it's a real, you know, Temple's football is the butt of a lot of jokes, but they've been pretty solid for the most part for, you know, since Al Golden got here, which is going back about 10 years at this point, 8 to 10 years. And I know everybody's feeling warm and fuzzy about Penn State and their big upset yesterday, but, you know, State College is 4 hours away, and Temple's right here in Philadelphia, and they play right here in Philadelphia. And I think they should get a little bit more notice.
Gordon, thank you for my transition to my final thought on Penn State, but which is for real. But I do agree with you, and I sort of, my fish and chips, I'm going to sort of hit on that a little bit. Temple did have a huge win Friday night, and it's almost like, yeah, it's just a shame. You know, they don't get enough attention. They had the win with 1 second left the previous week. So 2 big wins in a row and put them in the first place or first place tie, but they have the tiebreaker with Central Florida right now. But yeah, it's like with the Eagles and Sam Bradford coming into town, and the Sixers and their injury situation, and the Flyers getting started. Temple has been sort of pushed to the back, probably further back than they deserve. I agree with you. Having said that, I will. I was watching the Penn State game last night, and boy, it didn't give them. And this is why sports is so great, because it didn't get much of a chance against Ohio State. Nobody did. Ohio State's ranked 2nd in the country. Maybe some things people didn't pay attention to. Penn State got their linebackers back, Brandon Bell and Jason Kapinda, who have been out a lot of time. But they're still down 2 touchdowns going into the fourth quarter against a team that has outscored the opposition 62-7 in the fourth quarter this year. And it's not like Penn State is an offensive juggernaut, but special teams, they block the punt, kick a field goal. They get an offensive touchdown. Quarterback runs it in, McSorley. And then they block a field goal and run it back 60 yards for a touchdown. The scene of Penn State last night, even if you're not a Penn State fan, was just what's so great about sports. It was just an upset. Anything can happen. Even if going to the fourth quarter, you're down 2 touchdowns to the number 2 ranked team in the country that doesn't give up points in the fourth quarter, it can still happen, and that's why we watch sports. That's it for this week's show. So check out PhillyFanatics.com. Lots of great stuff. Lots of great stuff coming up. Sixer stuff coming up next week. Our show will be an Eagles-Cowboys preview games. The game's at 8:30. We'll be on at 6:30. So that's it for this week. For Gordon Glantz and Josh Landsberg, I'm Eric Fisher. Thank you for listening.